Well, it's it's a great honor to be chairing the final session of this amazing meeting. I first met Joe approximately 57 years ago, 1960-ish, when we were first-year mathematics students in Cambridge. And it's been a great pleasure to see Joe's enormous impact on cosmology over the years, starting with his 1968 paper on the silk damping. Joe has set a great example to us as well by completely denying the existence of retirement. And I note that in the past 5 years, that's between age 70 and 75, he's been an author on 115 refereed papers. So, Joe, congratulations on your extraordinary career. Over to you.
Okay, so thanks so much to all of you for this wonderful party. I thought what I would do is just talk a bit about the past, a bit about the present, a bit about the future. Let's think about the past. Now, I'm addressing this to the younger people also in part, because I think when you go into research, especially in astrophysics, it's great to have intuition, but you also need data, and it's a delicate combination of the two. And so I want to tell you about my sort of experience. So I was a graduate student at Harvard, just at a very good time, actually, just after the discovery of the CMB. But at that time, there were pundits, Zeldovich in particular, who for very good reasons. He didn't know about the CMB at that time, actually, but he was very a strong proponent of a cold universe, initially cold, for the simple reason that if it's cold and dense, it's unstable, and he could solve the galaxy formation problem beautifully, something its structure, as opposed to having to put initial conditions in by hand. And so my advisor at Harvard, who did know about the CMB, but as Jim will remember, was somewhat allergic to the Princeton community, David Laser, he was a very strong proponent of the cold Big Bang. And so there I was, beginning my PhD, working for David, and being urged to explore things like picnonuclear reactions in the Big Bang, which would then give you lots of iron, etc. Wonderful theory, actually. It gives you too much iron, in fact. But it could make the dust grains that rethermalize the photons in the CMB, things like this. So it was an interesting approach. However, I did manage to develop a different, more or less by accident, a different approach. And it was a question, again, of being at the right time, at the right place, at that time, just after discovery of the CMB. And where it began for me was this. There was a biannual conference at Woods Hole, a summer school, actually, on astrophysical simulation, high dynamical simulations. And every now and then, they'd do one astrophysics. And so you can probably recognize some of the people in this picture from 1966, when I was a second-year graduate student, looking for a thesis, not having one, apart from the cold universe. And so I'm here. And at the back, that's Alla Tumri. And there's Peter Goldreich. And let's see, there's George Field, among others. And Bill Saslaw, and so on. Okay, so... And that's where basically I did my summer project on photon diffusion in, you know, this coupled problem of hydrodynamics, basically in the context of the expanding universe, as the backdrop, the new discovered radiation field, and the obvious thing then was to think about the fluctuations, etc. And so it went. Okay, then I went on to think a lot about galaxy formation. And again, my approach was always, trying to do back of the envelope calculations and thinking about the analytic approach. But I think it's always important to remember, very true nowadays, that you need simulations with beautiful colors to make some impression. And so I didn't do simulations, but I managed to get the colors right. So this is one of my old transparencies. And so from a long time ago, but it does, it's interesting, it does have some interesting elements. So this is a cooling curve of hydrogen helium plasma. And so one applies this now to some galactic gas clouds or enormous cloud, doesn't really matter, and you basically set the cooling time equal to the free fall time, the dynamical time, and argue star formation should be efficient if you can cool efficiently and less efficient if you can't within that time scale. And so you can get a plot of density versus temperature that way. And so here it is, the density of my mean density of my intergalactic medium and temperature, we think of virial temperature. And then as the universe, the fluctuations develop by the usual gravitational stability theory, the fluctuations get large, eventually collapse. And so this is the cosmological prediction for RMS fluctuations from redshift 10 working your way down to redshift 0 with the mean density, you know, the usual simple over-density from spherical collapse of factor 200. And so within the bounds of this red region, which is the inverse of the cooling curve, of course, you can predict where clouds dissipate efficiently and should therefore make galaxies. And remarkably, when you put on one's estimates of all the different Hubble types, you get, you know, ellipticals, S0s, all, you know, and Lyman alpha clouds are just below the line because they have not collapsed significantly, most likely, and the galaxy clusters and groups are below the black line, are out beyond the red line because they do not dissipate on that average density, so distinct galaxies there. So that was, you know, that was where how I like to interpret data and apply intuition to data, and this is more or less what lies behind all the various scaling laws that we have today. Okay. Then I was looking for something else to do, and this was really another example of chance being in the right place at the right time. So I spent a summer in, more than a summer, a few months in Santa Barbara, where there was, in the fairly recent Institute for Theoretical Physics, there was some school on dark matter, and that is where cold dark matter essentially emerged as a paradigm. And that was where BBKS, Alex and Nick are here, that's where they developed their paper. And at the time, you know, both Alex and Dick had and Nick had been my postdocs, etc. So we were all working very closely, and I decided to go in a slightly different direction and began talking to particle physicists like Mark Srebrenicki in particular, and then Keith Olive, and we thought, well, you know, there must be, you know, if we believe in cold dark matter, and it's then it was popular to have this supersymmetric relic particle, the neutralino, the photino, had different names in those days, stable, it would be a Majorana particle, not with itself, maybe you get gamma rays and all that story. So you heard a bit about that from Marco. So that was very nice, and that was a question. And it's not just thinking of ideas like this, but you had to choose a field where there were no experiments yet, and there was no theory. So this basically, you know, makes it much easier to write papers. And again, in those days, it didn't take very long to write those early papers, so there was nothing to compare them with. Actually, it's not quite true. When we wrote that first paper, there was one possible antiproton discovered by Louis Alvarez and his group. And it, in fact, someone reinterpreted it as the first magnetic monopole. That idea went away, but I believe it survived as a possible antiproton. But with one particle, you can't do much. So there was no theoretical constraints. Okay, so let me now address the question of what should we be doing next in cosmology. I think you've had a lot on the dark matter issue. I mean, it's very frustrating now because we've been developing bigger and bigger experiments in dark matter with both for direct detection, indirect detection, accelerator experiments, and so far we've found no convincing hints. We've had occasional moments of excitement. We thought we discovered a gamma ray line or a positron signal or something. All these have basically more or less vanished. And we're running into, in a few probably $1 billion or two time, into euros time, in terms of expensive experiment, we're going to run into the neutrino, the coherent neutrino scattering barrier from the atmosphere of the sun. So in direct detections, we're going to run into a similar financial barrier if we want to go to a more energetic a proton collider. You know, already having spent $8 billion on the LHC, it's not clear if you'll find nothing, you can go on further. And when we look hard at the dwarf galaxies, again, we're still seeing no indications, even though the dark matter dominated over dark matter type signal. So maybe if, you know, giving young people my advice, maybe dark matter is not the right place, the most exciting place to be at the moment, unless you have some brilliant new idea. It's hard to find, you know, we're running out of experimental options. We will be eventually. So what about dark energy then? Well, here we're in a booming area. We all have all these wonderful experiments underway. The trouble is that, as you've heard, everything today is focusing on lambda being a constant and P equals minus rho. Now, I don't know how widely known this is, but the first paper explaining P equals minus rho was written in 1933 by Georges Lemaître. I forgot to bring a copy to put it on my slide. So the idea of vacuum fluctuations has been around for a very long time. And it, of course, has been revived now with the recent recent emphasis on understanding better this mysterious, very, very small number that we have to live with, which we're measuring in the recent universe as acceleration. So I wonder, really, if experiment is, again, it's one has to do the experiments, but again, advising people on where to go, maybe one should think perhaps of explaining this with theory. And again, the problem with the theory, alternative theory as to giving us some hint of how to understand lambda better, is that we clearly need something new, and here are the only two reasons my ideas I've come across. One is that it might be some sort of quintessence, that is, you know, to connect the early universe, the present universe having a very high value, early alert one today. Again, none of the theories out there seem to be at all convincing. They're just phenomenological at best. Or we can go for this more exotic idea of a multiverse, anthropically based, and I do not have a high opinion of that, because while you might say that it's credible, I think Martin Rees made that case. It's explanatory in the sense there are many things that can be explained, but it's got no predictions and it cannot be falsified. So it's not a very satisfactory area for me to think about as to work in, as even being, I would say, physics, let alone a project future research. Okay, so what then? The microwave background. So again, this has been amazingly productive, and we have a clear, maybe two clear ways ahead, okay? So one, I will summarize as to be or not to be. So this is looking for the polarized beam. So the problem here is that we have no robust prediction. I mean, who knows what the reheating temperature was? And the B mode depends critically on that reheating temperature to some significant power even. So, you know, we have to do this. We have to search. We have to get better limits. Go to R of 0.001. That may be our final limit. But there's no prediction, robust prediction. So one will find this maybe a little bit hard to sell to the various competing projects, but it's very important fundamental physics, of course. So another way you might go is spectral distortions. Well, the beauty of this is that since FIRAS, there's a huge amount of parameter space that we can explore because we can improve the FIRAS bound on deviations from black body of the cosmic background radiation by, you know, 3 or 4 orders of magnitude. And I think one of the major hopes would be to look for the dissipation signal of galaxies. And the beauty of this signal is that while we've measured lots of galaxies, you know, in this range over here, which are the standard galaxies and clusters, you can work your way down to the dwarfs, okay, because those structures dissipate too. And in principle, though, that will give you a spectral distortion. All of this happens indeed in the, you know, in the after black body thermalization, after the first few months, there's a period then where you can actually trap a signal. The problem with this, I think it's a great thing to do. Maybe it should be the prime motivation. Pixie could not get that sensitive. Maybe the new experiments will, being discussed. But the problem is, all you get at the end of the day is one number, okay? The mu distortion. And that means it's going to be hard to interpret, but still, it's a target. Okay, so I think there is one way to go, and this is now I want to discuss the future. And I think the region that's most poorly explored, we haven't even mentioned this really in the past 3 days, is the Dark Ages. Okay, and let me try to explain why I think that it's the time to really push hard on the Dark Ages. So so here in this schematic, you can see the temperature of gas compared to the CMB temperature. And in recent times, you've got lots of non-linearity, galaxies forming, black holes, enemy X-rays, and so the IGM heats up. But there was a while early on when the CMB temperature cooled down at 3 Kelvin, where the matter cooled even more. So in principle, at that epoch, there should be hydrogen clouds, the ones that made today's galaxies, and you can map them in principle in absorption against the CMB. And this is a totally unexplored area. People are now focusing a lot on reionization of the universe, very important. But to go back even further would be really, you know, understanding cosmology, I think, even better, okay? So, and this is the reason why you want to do this, okay? So here is the CMB, okay? This is the power spectrum of the CMB. This is the predicted power spectrum for the first clouds in the universe, which I've cut off at the mass, which is too small for gas to cool and condense. So there's a huge parameter range. Remember, we're talking about, you know, these are wave numbers, these are million solar mass inverse megaparsecs, so this corresponds to galaxies over here somewhere, clusters basically over here. This is the first peak, 100 odd megaparsecs. And so, you know, the CMB runs out of power, right? So but if we can explore this region, we suddenly get the possibility of having enormously more information on structure formation. That's the only, if we can tap this. And so the trouble is, you want to go to get the building blocks, the million solar mass clouds, you've got to go to Ks of 10 to 100. That means going from 21 centimeters now to redshift 50, which means going down to 30 megahertz. And that is very, very challenging. Okay. But there is a prediction, okay? So if you could ever do this, there's an amazing prediction, okay? If you can get all this information out of the sky. The prediction is that all inflation models robustly predict something, and that is primordial non-Gaussianity, and there's a simple expression for it, and people debate about whether this is accurate to a factor of a few, but let me just show you the expression. It's the scalar index, 0.96 measured by Planck, minus 1, okay, modulus of that. That's about 0.03. And what you're measuring is this parameter. It's the quadratic correction, the first indications of non-Gaussianity, FNL, to the temperature fluctuations. Okay, so that should be the target, 0.01, let's say. However, it's really, really difficult because Planck limits, and in general, all CMB limits ever, I will argue, are stuck at about 10. You can never do better for this than 10. The reason is you just count the number of modes on the sky. So in the CMB, we work to L of about 1,000, and you have about 1 million modes, as you heard in Francois' talk earlier. 1 million modes, and 1/√1,000,000 is 0.1%. You can never do better than 0.1% cosmology with a CMB. So you're going to be stuck at FNL of order 10. Let's suppose we take the next step, which is galaxy surveys, and the biggest one of all is LSST, which is promising us 20 billion redshifts, photometric redshifts, okay? That's enormous. You'll think that will give you a huge increase in the number of modes. The trouble is that a galaxy is a very dirty, independent probe. And so if you're optimistic, you might increase the number of modes by a factor of 100. Now, no one has really done this calculation in detail, but this is just a guess, okay? Which means you can win a factor of 10 on the CMB when I take the square root of that. So, okay, that's great. I can now get down to FNLs of order 1, which is more or less what they forecast in the new generation Euclid, etc., of large-scale galaxy surveys. So that's out there. You can see that for yourself. To do really better, there is only one way to go. You've got to increase the number of modes enormously, and that is the dark ages. And by suddenly opening yourself up to all these million solar mass clouds, you can increase the number of modes. And not only that, it's even better, because now you can slice the universe up, because you know 21 centimeter frequency so well, into, you know, maybe 100 slices along line of sight. And by tomography, you win another factor of 100. So I think you can, in principle, get up to numbers that would improve on large-scale structure by number of modes by 10,000, accuracy by 100. So suddenly you're down from the of order 10 to of order 0.01. So in principle, you can do that. Okay, but the problem is if you go to the dark ages, but there is a slight problem. You can't do it from the Earth. It's impossible because the SKA will indeed go to 30 megahertz. That's in their vision. But we've got the Earth's ionosphere. It's going to be really noisy. And we've got, you know, cell phones, and, you know, all the usual things, even in Western Australia. And so there's no way they can get the needed sensitivity. So the best place to go is the most radio quiet site in the inner solar system, which is the far side of the moon. Okay, so that's where we have to go. And so the scheme is that we will eventually, I'll give you more details in a second, send out lunar rovers, and they will be carrying large rolls of mylar. And on the mylar, we'll 3D print dipoles. We need dipoles. We're talking about 10 meter type, your TV antenna type wavelength. So, and we roll these dipoles over the backside of the moon, over a large area, and that'll be the basic lunar radio interferometer. And here are some numbers. You basically can estimate what sort of diameter you might need, and that's of order 100 kilometers to work at a wavelength of 10 meters. You need millions of dipoles to get this weak signal. SKA will have 500,000 dipoles. The number is not crazy to have millions of dipoles or 10 million dipoles. Here's the real problem. You're looking for a 10 milli-K signal against galactic foregrounds of thousands of Kelvin. So that's the real problem. But the signal you're looking for is lines. It's different in frequency from the more continuous galactic foregrounds. And perhaps if you're very clever, you'll think of ways to beat the noise down. Okay, so that's the story for radio astronomy. Now, if we do this, there's a bonus, okay? Because you can also do amazing infrared astronomy on the moon. So let me tell you that story briefly. And this, again, is a vision for the future. If you're an infrared astronomer, you really should be thinking about this. So on the moon, near the South Pole, there are a lot of large craters. And being near the South Pole, being North Pole, means you're in sort of more or less perpetual twilight. It never gets too hot or too cold as it does on the equator. And some of these craters, and I'll show you a close-up of the Shackleton crater, which is one of these, this one, 20 kilometers across, okay, 4 kilometer high rims, covered with ice, most likely, as mapped by an Indian satellite. We're not quite sure of that. And very cold. It's been mapped with the NASA Diviner spacecraft, 30 Kelvin. 30 Kelvin all the time, okay? It's in permanent shadow. So a great place, and what Camille Flammarion noticed a long time ago was that the rims of the crater are in perpetual sunlight, being near the pole. He called that la lumière perpétuelle. Right? So you can imagine solar power and your telescopes, and in fact, the prospects to explore the moon will almost certainly use the proximity of craters like this, because that's where you'll be able to get permanent power, which you need. You don't want to have a two-week gap in your power if you're building things on the moon, etc. So that would be the idea. Now, how realistic is any of this? Are we ever going to go to the moon? Well, the answer is we're already there. So first, the Chinese are there. So this is a Chinese telescope, the only telescope on the moon. The company that built this has a big advertising slogan on it. But so that's the Chinese rover, and they're planning more like this. But we're not content to let the Chinese lead the way. So now there is a European effort. So there's a new Director General of ESA who's been giving speeches about going to the moon to build a moon village. And so this is an artist schematic of life on the moon in the moon village. The idea is to use local materials plus water to build all your construction there. And he talks about business and tourism on the moon. Those are the two of the goals. And the idea is to get a lot of commercial support behind this. And the business might include mining or whatever, the tourism, whatever. The time is ripe now to try to convince our leaders to think about building telescopes on the moon. Because as was the story with our previous exploits in space, the main example I can quote is the International Space Station. It cost a huge amount of money. But because we built that, NASA also built the Space Shuttle, and hence came the Hubble Space Telescope. So 5 or 10% of a mega venture like this could easily cover the costs of any of these futuristic telescopes. Now, let me conclude by telling you that the US presence currently on the moon is this, okay? But the US is having second thoughts. And I'll finish by showing you from the newspapers yesterday. Boots on the moon seems to be the next project, and you have Trump with a small astronaut there. Okay, so So we're talking about, you know, 2040, 2035, 2040 for doing this, establishing a base of them. It'll be mostly robotics, but there'll have to be a human-robotic interface, partly because of the time delay. You have to have, you can't just control these things from afar because the robots will have all sorts of instantaneous problems, maybe. So you need humans present too to direct them properly. So, you know, agencies are busy exploring all of this now, and I'm hoping that telescopes will be part of their thinking. It's not obvious, but it ought to be. You want more than just a golf course on the moon. Okay, so thank you. That's all. I would like to thank especially Elizabeth, Gary, Johanna, Madeline for all of their help this week. It's been amazing. So. And thank you, all of you, for coming to Paris. It's been wonderful, a great occasion to think about the dark side of things and other sides too. So thank you.
Well, that was a fantastic way to end the meeting. Thank you very much, Joe, and thank you for everything you've given to astronomy and cosmology.